Welcome to Changing Conversations with Billy Burke and me, Sarah Philp. This is a podcast creating space for conversations with, for and by educators. Conversation is one of the oldest ways to nurture the conditions for growth and improvement. When we talk about what matters, we come alive, and conversation has the power to guide us into new and different actions, offering the potential for great things. We bring you conversations that have resonance both now and in the future. With the help of guests and the odd solo episode, we explore leadership, learning and well-being. We have the conversations we know you want to listen to. In this episode, we reconnect with James Nottingham from Challenge Learning. James has recently published his 12th book, Teach Brilliantly. And in this conversation, we consider what's changed over the years, why this book and why now. And in particular, we dig into the topic of learner engagement. How do we know that they are learning? What does it mean? What does it look like? We hope you enjoy. James, it's lovely to see you again. I was just looking back to see when we last spoke as part of the Changing Conversations podcast, and it was, or at least the episode was published in October 2020, and it was episode 16. So, and this conversation is going to be episode 109. Wow. I have to say I'm a little disappointed it's not 116. That would have just been perfect in every way. But regardless of that, we are delighted to see you again and delighted to have the opportunity to chat. But how are you and how have you been for the last few years, I guess?
Yeah, lovely to be back. And I'm sorry it's not 116 also. But a lot's happened since then. I think the pandemic has changed so much for so many of us. And I think schools particularly, I feel as if I'm going into different places these days compared to what I was pre-pandemic in many, many, many ways. I think there's a few things that have changed for the better, but most of the things, it seems to me, to be greater challenges. So that's certainly something that I think about and reflect on regularly on my travels and going in. And it's not just in Scotland or England or even in Europe. I mean, everywhere I go, there are significant differences and worrying differences. I think the teacher shortage particularly is something that... is a major issue that I've noticed since pre-pandemic. I did a webinar for a school in Perth in Western Australia that I've been working with long-term. I did one for them yesterday. The early hours at 5 a.m. for me and 1 p.m. for them. And they're a new school. That part of Perth is burgeoning. And so there's quite a lot of new schools, and they collected together, they hired two HR specialists to gather together a good pool of people and do all the checks and all the basics before then the schools would interview whenever they needed people. And they were telling me that pre-pandemic, they would typically have about 250 staff in that pool at any one time. And currently, they've got fewer than 20. I mean, it's just astonishing. So that's one of the many things that I notice, Sarah. But I think the students are still, what shall we say, can be as excited as ever, but they can also be as distracted as ever. I was in filming some model lessons last week in an international school in Amsterdam. And I mean, it was just such a buzz. I mean, it was a proper... Mm. 2 days of utter joy. So when we're able to put all the other stuff aside and crack on with learning, it can be as joyous as ever, I think. But it just seems to be there's so many other obstacles in our way compared to before.
It's good to hear that joy is still there. And you assume, or I assume, that joy is still there. And I do see evidence of it as well. But sometimes the narrative gets dominated by the harder stuff, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, in many ways, you fight the fires that are in front of you. And it would be lovely lovely to go and engage in the things that we really want to engage in. And I mean, it's been forever for leaders, particularly that they went into teaching for the sake of teaching, and then they're now leaders and they're struggling desperately to find time to be back in the classroom. And so it's not exactly a pandemic problem, but I think that we see it more now. More of us are struggling to focus on the pedagogy, the teaching, the learning, the engagement, the joy of it. And that's a sad state of affairs. And of course, there's the problem of what we used to call truancy, I suppose, but, you know, absences. I mean, it seems that it's so easy for kids to miss school these days, because it used to be parents are heading off to work. So no, you bugger, you're going off to school. I'm sorry. I know you've got one limb hanging from you and you've got snot everywhere, but I'm going to work, so you're going to have to go in. But now, well, I'm working from home, so yeah, just have the day. And there's all sorts of things going on that but yes, let's focus on the joy. Let's focus on the good stuff.
Yes. Yes, and I suppose that in some ways takes us to your most recent book, and you've written many books over the years, haven't you? How many do you know off the top of your head?
This is the 12th book.
The 12th book, wow. Yes.
I feel almost scared, though, Sarah, to write my 13th. Not through any superstition thing, because I actually will habitually choose 13 if there is a 13th row or a 13th room, because I'm so anti-superstition. So maybe that's a superstition itself. But anyway, I am scared to write my 13th because, as John Hattie told me once upon a time, that Visible Learning was his 13th book. So I feel as if you've got to write 12 to kind of warm up, and then your 13th is the one that makes the headlines. But so I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do for my 13th. But this is my 12th book. It's called Teach Brilliantly. And I suppose we do it all the time, whichever book we've written most recently we're most proud of. But I would say that this is definitely the one I think that is my best book. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about it and why now.
Well, I think it connects back to what we talked about in the introduction, that during the pandemic, we all engaged in way more webinars than ever before. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, in fact, maybe we barely did a webinar before the pandemic. And it caused me to really tighten my message and to make absolutely sure that every piece of research was nailed on, reliable, and the strategies that go with it were absolutely going to work. Because I think pre-pandemic, I, like many of us, relied to a certain extent on personality, on rapport, on building relationships with the people that we're working with, and saying such things as, do you know what I mean? And they would typically nod. But when you're doing a webinar and there's a few hundred people, and I mean, you're nodding very nicely now, and it's very, very encouraging. You're a good listener. But when you're doing a webinar to a few hundred and you don't know who you're looking at, and then, you don't get that feedback. So you feel like, I'm going to have to really be very clear. And I've got 1 hour. We can't be 1.5 hours. It can't be a whole day together. It's a 1 hour webinar. Yeah. And if you're not right at it, people are just going to go and make a cup of tea or put it on mute and do something else and just kind of keep peering now and again. So it was looking back, it was a really good discipline to tighten that message. And so the book came out of that, really, that it was my first post-pandemic. It feels, I don't want to linger too much, I don't want to perseverate on the pandemic, but I think things have changed, and this is my one and only book post-pandemic. And that's not to write off the others beforehand, but I wanted to, it was driven by this idea. We've got so much to worry about and so much to focus on and so much to deal with that there has to come a point when we say, yes, I am concerned about absences. Yes, I am concerned about the lack of recruits going into the profession. Yes, I am concerned about the budgets being cut and wages not increasing. So all of those things I can be concerned about. But when it comes to Monday morning, the bell's gone and I'm in the classroom with my students, I've got to crack on with it and I've got to do a good job. And I think I've got to get right at it as quickly and effectively as I can. And so what I wanted to do with this book was to collect together the whole range rather than focus on just one topic as I have with other books. I wanted to gather the whole range of top tips, so to speak, but driven by that research. And I know that sounds a bit of a cliche these days, but yeah, start with the meta-analyses. What are the meta-analyses saying? Yes, but then how does that apply in the classroom? And so I try to gather it together and put it all into one book. My intention was to write a short summary, a sort of a 60,000 word book. I ended up writing 145,000 words. So it was a short summary about a whole lot of topics. That was the purpose. I tried to gather it all together in one weighty tome, as it turned out, rather than some short, snappy title. But yeah.
And we'll maybe come on to this, but you know, teaching is complex work, so can't always be brought back to something short and snappy. But I wonder, when you look back over the years you've been doing what you're doing and the 11 books that took you to the 12th, are there key differences? Are there things that have significantly changed or shifted in perhaps emphasis that you notice when you look back over your work?
Yeah, I think there would be a lot of changes, actually. Very much about tightening the message, very much about getting rid of the fluff and just getting down to it and getting on with it. I'm supporting a new author in Australia right now, and she's writing a book about philosophy for children, which, I mean, that was my beginning in teaching in the early 90s. And so it is lovely to support her with that. And I suggested, I'm a fan of this idea, ready, fire, aim. It's no good if you're playing darts, of course, or hunting, but it's great in terms of teaching, where ready is you give them the shortest, briefest, most efficient introduction that you can, and you say to your pupils that that's what you've done. I've given you just enough to make a start. And then fire is they go and play with it, they go and try it out, and you see how they're getting on. And typically they're going to be making mistakes because you haven't gone through every explanation that you might have done. You've given them just enough to make a start, they've had a go at it. And then because you gave a very short introduction, you can then, you've made space to get on to the teaching later in the lesson rather than right at the beginning. We typically give the main part of the teaching at the beginning, but this is about pushing it back a bit and giving them time to experiment. And so to link back to this book this colleague of mine is writing, she's writing a playbook about philosophy for children, and I've seen a lot of books coming out as playbook, and I've never really known what that means, playbook exactly. But I said, well, how about taking that ready, fire, aim, and let's go for an amended version. So ready, play, and then refine, I think we said. So ready, play, refine. And I think that's a good way to go. My earlier books were, here's the main part, but here's the nuances, here's the exceptions, here's the research, here's the extra elements that you can add. Here's what you also need to think about. And I think a lot of people went, bah! But like, how am I going to do it? Because I wanted to show there's always exceptions. There's always, we always have to filter every strategy, every theory through our professional judgment. And I think it became too much right up front. And so I think now it's a bit more ready, play, aim is quite a good way. Already, play, refine is a pretty good way to go. So here's something, go try it. And it's the essence, the key thing, go and try that. And then once they've tried it and say, yeah, okay, that's working. And that gives you a bit of a boost. That makes you feel, okay, all right, then that's nice to see. But what about? And then when it becomes the but what about, then you get into the refining afterwards. So I think I'm much more keen on that than I used to be. Focused more on that. Yeah. And I mean, there's quite a few changes, but that would be one.
I like that approach, James, because I think it taps into natural curiosity that young people have, you know, and you've described some things that have changed in recent years, and I absolutely agree with that. But what hasn't changed is just that natural love of learning that can still be there. Maybe they won't sit and listen for 10 minutes about the theory before getting into things. So let's just get them curious, let them free, experiment, get excited about the learning, and then follow up with the rest. So great approach. And I think that kind of thinking is needed at these times, because there is an issue with engagement, isn't there? You've outlined that you've seen this in schools in different places. So let's get into that a little bit. What do you think has driven that? Obviously, we've mentioned pandemic, but it seems pretty clear that young people are not as engaged as they were before. So what's changed, and what do we need to do about that?
I'm struggling because I don't want to repeat cliches that we've all heard all the time. I mean, devices are obviously the absolute, and TikTok. I mean, it is crack cocaine for kids. I mean, TikTok is just insane, but that's one of many that there are millions upon millions going into research and development to hook people and keep them in. I think that's part of it. I think the fast pace of life. I saw there was an old episode of Snoopy on Sky recently. So I said to these kids, look, to my own kids, look at this. I used to watch this all the time. And I put it on and nothing happens. I mean, there's this dog just lying around, and then this little yellow bird comes in, flies down, sits next to Snoopy, nothing happens, and then the bird goes again. And I'm thinking, how on earth did this keep my attention? I mean, my kids were like, oh my God, Dad, you know, what was the point of this? And I was thinking to myself, yeah, what was the point of it? But I loved it at their age. You know, I've got three kids S. Six in S3 and P7, and they are, yeah, everything is fast paced, really, really fast paced, and they are boom, 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 boom. And so I think that's a major challenge for us in education, huge challenge. How on earth do we compete with that, with the crack cocaine of the internet? You know, I do. I've recorded quite a lot of videos. That's another thing that's come out of the pandemic. I think I've got better at presenting to a camera than ever before. And watching those videos back, almost always when I'm editing them, I put them on 1.1 times or 1.2, or sometimes even 1.3 times. You know, because I'm thinking, oh my God, James, just speed up, will you? Why are you speaking so slowly about this? And I used to listen to some particularly American presenters, then I'm thinking, oh my God, please slow down. I'm really struggling to keep up with you. You're using all this jargon and you're going so very, very quickly. Just slow down. And now I've got the opposite. I'm watching myself thinking, just, you're stuck on 33 and a third. I mean, even that reference, most people will think, well, what's he even talking about? You know, so I think speed is a problem. I think the number of distractions going on for the kids, I think it is a good thing. Personally, I think it is a good thing to keep mobile phones out of schools. And when you look at the PISA results, it's interesting that they say mobile phones keep them out, but devices can be useful, can be good. I worry that my kids, everything's done on iPads, and I do worry about that, but I'm a child of the 70s and 80s who, you know, who was got very excited about the first Casio watch. So maybe, you know, I'm just showing my age there. But so when I write about engagement, I don't want to add yet another polemic about all the problems of technology in the modern world. What I focus on is, how do you know your students are engaged? And typically we talk about eyes to the front or tracking the teacher, or kids are nodding, or they're not whispering to their mates, and so on and so forth. But then when I'm working with teachers, I'll show them photographs of kids in schools. That's my sort of my hobby, as it were. I love photography in schools to sort of capture that essence. And I did a working trip to Japan recently, and I showed some photographs of these kids in classes and asked teachers which of these kids are engaged. And of course, then, well, how do you know? It's really difficult to know. And yet we're making snap judgments all the time in the classroom about who's engaged and who's not. We're glancing over and we are deciding in a fraction of a second if that student is disengaged, and then we do something about it, or if they are engaged, then maybe we leave them to it, or maybe we praise them for it. So there's these lots, very quick snap judgments. But when we think about it, actually is really, really, really difficult to know. And give some examples of what do we mean by engagement. For example, how many of us will be reading a book and we're going through the words, we're turning the pages, and a few pages in, we realize we've not taken in a word. And yet to the outside world, we're engaged, and yet we weren't engaged. And there's lots and lots and lots of examples like that. And so what I try to do is shift the emphasis away from engagement as giving the impression of taking notice, and shift it more to thinking. If we think about engagement as thinking, I want my students to engage. And what I mean by that is I want them to think about what is taking place, think about their learning, think about connections. And then that links very nicely is the section in my book looking at the research about the differences between classrooms where teachers have got low expectations compared to classrooms where teachers have got high expectations. And I would summarize the differences as, in classrooms where there are low expectations, the emphasis is get your work done, and the teacher is spending a lot of their time patrolling the classroom, walking up and down, giving praise for kids getting on, and the opposite for those who aren't. Whereas in a classroom where there's high expectations, it's much more about make sure you understand this. So it's not make sure you finish it, it's make sure you understand this. And you notice there's far less patrolling and much more teachers chatting, listening, questioning kids to understand what the kids are thinking about, to understand where they are in depth of learning, for example, or connections, or or what they're thinking about in terms of the three feedback questions. What am I trying to achieve here, and how much progress have I made, and what am I going to do next? And so when I work with staff and when I write about engagement, I try to shift that emphasis away from giving the outward signs of taking notice and much more to that internal thinking about. And when we think of engagement as thinking, it leads to different responses, I think. If we have time, I could give a very good example of that, but I'm conscious that I've been speaking for a long time there, Billy. But yeah, that's the main change.
It's really useful. And also, to touch on the technology aspect, you know, because as you mentioned, young people, there's a negative narrative about, oh, they don't have the attention span, they're addicted to phones. You know, there's really good reason that they're addicted to phones, as you've mentioned. It's almost psychological warfare on getting them hooked to certain apps. And almost what you're saying is we need to slow down a bit, because thinking's in your own time, and that's an individual thing. So, you know, do you want to see classrooms where the pace is slower, where there's almost a calmness? Is it a blend?
Oh, that's a good question.
It's a hard question.
It is. I think, yes, not always, but yes. Yeah. There's a wonderful photograph I've got of this primary student sat in a jacuzzi, but it doesn't have any water in it. It's just a jacuzzi that they've got in a corridor of a primary school just outside of London. And I'm walking along the corridor and I said to him, "Are you all right?" He says, "Yes, thanks." I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm in the learning pit." I says, "Oh, yeah. What does that mean then?" He says, "Well, if you're in the learning pit, you're thinking really hard about something. You're trying to work on a problem that's in front of you, and you're focusing on it." I said, and to me, I was thinking, that's a great definition of the learning pit. I said, "So why have you sat in this?" Which, as I say, was a jacuzzi that they just haven't plumbed in, you know? And he says, "If anyone sits in this pit, it means leave me alone. I need thinking time." Now, that was just absolutely brilliant in my mind, that it's okay to take yourself off for some thinking time. That there was absolutely the number one focus was about thinking. This example that I alluded to before, so it was a 4-form entry primary school, and I visited all P1 classes, all four of them. And this would have been in late October last year. So, of course, those primary ones have been in the school, 2 months-ish. The school doesn't have an early years unit attached to it. So the teachers didn't know these kids, 110 kids from the whole neighborhood coming into the school, split randomly into 4 primary one classes. And this shows you just what a difference there is in terms of high expectations versus low. And I do think it's very, very interesting in PISA, where the biggest difference in all UK countries, and I know in the most recent PISA they split Scotland from the rest of the UK, but in all 4 UK countries, there is a much, much, much bigger difference between one classroom and the next than there is between one school and the next. The variance is astonishing between one classroom and the next. I mean, that's a typical picture worldwide, but in the UK, it's even more pronounced. There's even bigger difference. And yet we have less of a difference between schools, which is crazy to think how much time and money is spent on on these academies and private schools and grammar schools and goodness knows what. And actually the biggest difference isn't between schools, it's between classrooms. So anyway, so I went to this school, four primary one classrooms. One, the first classroom that I visited, it was an absolute joy. The teacher said, right then, children, can you come over to the front and let's get in our thinking circle. So all the children sort of stood around, held hands in a circle, sat down on the carpet at the front. And she then read them a story, Where the Wild Things Are. And then she got them to think about, what do you mean by wild? And the sorts of questions she asked were, what does it mean to be wild? Can we be wild? What's the difference between a wild animal and a house pet? Are zoo animals wild? Are they less wild than the ones who are not in zoo? I mean, so some really, and for me, that, you know, it was quite philosophical. So you can imagine I enjoyed it anyway. But what I'm telling you this about is the reason is because the teacher only three times in the lesson made any corrective comments about behavior. She said, now look at our circle. It's become a bit of a blob. Can we adjust, please? Let's get back into our circle. So the vast majority of what she focused on and what she talked about and what she got the children engaged in was the thinking. And they made superb progress. I mean, the kids, you know, these were four-year-old kids, you know, the limbs were stretching out. One girl turned and started plaiting the hair of another girl. At one point, there was a little fella, he was face down on the carpet, but he was listening and turning his head and listening to whoever was talking. And then he put his thumb up to say that he wanted to say something. And it was just an absolute joy. And the progress they made in their thinking was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. She had very high expectations for behavior, but she barely mentioned behavior. She'd obviously set up these routines. And as I say, three times she made some sort of corrective comments, but otherwise it was all on the thinking. Then I went to another two classes and they weren't quite as effective, but similar sorts of activities going on. But then I went to the final classroom, and this is why I'm not mentioning the name of the school, because the final classroom, and they'd obviously, this team of primary one teachers had obviously planned together because they were all doing the same activity. And so she got the thinking circle, started reading Where the Wild Things Are, but they made almost no progress with the inquiry. Why? Because most of the comments she made was about behavior. Keep your hands to yourself. Will you sit up straight, please? Will you turn this way? Now, will you stop talking to each other? I need you focused on that. Anytime a limb dared to stretch out, it was almost like she got a machete and chopped it off and hung it on the wall as a threat to all the other kids. And she was focused primarily on behave yourself. Do as you're told. Let's get this done. Whereas in that first example, the priority, even though she had very high expectations for behavior, was on the inquiry, was on the learning, was on the thinking. And so that massively stood out for me. There was more time to think in that first example than was in the last example. Because in the last example, most of the time it was focused on kids' behavior. And so they didn't have time to think deeply. And they kept up with it. And they kept up with each other's behavior and they noticed each other's behavior. So these kids are very good at noticing fast pace. But that first example, she slowed it down and focused on the thinking. And it was just, I so wish that I had those recordings. But of course, I'm not sure that's professionally ethical to say. And look at this fourth one. Let's not do that. But we've all seen that. We've all seen examples like that. And I think we have to get all pupils. And I know it sounds high in the sky for some of us with some of the behaviors of some of the students, particularly in high schools. But I do think that the more we show that we are engaged in thinking, that we are engaged in connections, in wondering, it gives us a better chance than showing that we're engaged primarily in behaviour.
Yeah. I know we're labouring the point here about engagement, but it's massive at the moment. And what you've described is the difference to two teachers doing the same thing but taking a pretty different approach. And you spoke about rapport. I mean, at the end of the day, when you're thinking, does it have to be sitting at your desk, you know, looking like you're paying attention to someone? Or are you thinking when you're out for a walk or for a run or having a coffee with someone? Or, you know, trying to create that first group where it was okay to stretch out, it was okay not to be looking at an adult for 50 minutes or an hour nonstop. But you were thinking and you were doing it in your own way and you were contributing. Now, I know that's hard to replicate in every situation, but I do think at the moment we need to think much more carefully about the environment that we're asking young people to engage in for long, long periods, hours each day, that probably don't mirror the adult world and the way that we all engage and work these days, and that seems to be becoming a bit of a barrier to engagement rather than conducive to learning. So I love those examples.
Yes.
Thanks for that.
Yes. Billy, I think also for some kids, they've learned habits, such good habits of showing that they are listening, that it works for them. And we think of those kids as good kids,
yeah,
good pupils. But there's others who haven't learned those habits, and it can be exhausting. I mean, I see this in my own family. If I take my eldest two children, my son is ASD and also ADHD. And I mean, he's just utterly, utterly wiped by the end of the day. He comes back from school and he's almost like a zombie. But he's just started work experience now. He's in S3. And when he comes back from work experience, he is absolutely buzzing. I mean, like, high as a kite, because he's been out, he's been chopping logs, he's been doing all sorts of exciting stuff for him. And going to the engagement piece, he has always been by far the most intuitive when it comes to maths. He feels maths. He's got a good sense. If you asked a mental maths question, he will have a good sense of what it's likely to be. And then you need to give him time to work it out. But his literacy rates are really poor. His processing skills are much slower than the average. But his mental maths is really good. Compare that to my eldest, who's always had a fear of maths, always hated it. She's great with language, hates maths. But when it came to high school and setting, you know where I'm going with this, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
She was in the top set for maths, and he is in the bottom set for maths. Completely the wrong way round if it was based purely on mathematical nous. But she has learnt brilliant ways to show that she's being polite and show that she's engaged and show that she's willing, and he hasn't. It takes so much energy, so much effort, that if you don't worry about him not showing that, he can then put his energy into thinking. And it's classic when we're hanging out, all of us together. If you don't mention anything about the way he sat and the way he's got his head down and so on, he'll join in. But if you say, Harry, are you with us, son? And, you know, it's almost like, oh, God, whereas my eldest is, every time you come into a room, she kind of does a little wave and a little smile, because that's the nice thing to do. You only saw her seconds ago. You only popped out for a coffee. You came back and she's giving you a little wave. Well, but that's that social creature thing compared to my son, who just hasn't learned that. And so I think if the priority in a classroom is to show that you are engaged and show that you are focused, then my daughter will do it and do it very well and get praise for it and get on. And my son, if he manages it, and that's a huge if, then you know what, don't expect him to actually think about the topic or the concept or the ideas, because he's putting all of his effort into showing that he's engaged. It's Yeah, we've got a lot. I'm learning an awful lot at the moment about all of this. I find it fascinating.
It is fascinating, James, and I'm also interested in how what you're talking about there around engagement and measuring engagement by the thinking that's happening. How does that also then kind of relate to working with teachers and teacher professional development and learning? And what are the parallels? I mean, maybe we're not managing the limbs and the behaviors in the same way, but that whole idea of creating space for the thinking, how do we do that for teachers, or how can we do that better perhaps for teachers?
I think things actually might be improving a bit, Sarah, from my perspective, because I remember when I was a full-time teacher, whenever there was a lesson observation, there was this assumption, general assumption amongst my colleagues and me, that the member of senior leadership team is in to check on your teaching and in effect to watch your performance. And so when you knew that they were coming in, you made the lesson a bit more high energy than maybe it would be. You're up the front more. You're making it a bit funnier, a bit more fast-paced and so on. You couldn't possibly keep it up for all every lesson every week, but you do it because you've been observed. Whereas I think your work, Sarah, and I know this sounds like blowing smoke up, but you know, your work in terms of coaching and listening and questioning and wondering, I think that's become much more common these days. And thank goodness for that, because our profession is a cerebral one. Yes, there's a performance element to it. Yes, there is a sense of, what shall we say, crowd control. And I do find it fascinating when I work in the States that there's an overwhelming number of superintendents who were PE teachers. Because PE teachers are absolute geniuses with crowd control, you know? And like, why is it that crowd control is the number one that leads to you being a superintendent of a district, you know? I mean, it's something crazy, like 40% of all superintendents used to be like what, you know? You don't find art teachers being superintendents, you know, and music teachers, or, and heaven forbid, getting in a philosophy teacher, you know, they'll be too busy wondering whether what teaching is, never mind leading. So it's, I think we've got better at it, but we've still got a long way to go. We must switch up these lesson observations away from the performative and much more to the cognitive, much more to the philosophy, much more to the sequences that we're engaged in, and what routines have we built? I think we've talked about this before, about last time we talked a little bit about football. I noticed that the thing today is about, they talk about the transitions. I mean, they didn't a few years ago. I never even heard the word transition mentioned. Isn't it? It's like almost every single pundit needs to talk about the transition. And I think that's quite an important thing when it comes to education. There's, I see some amazing transitions, you know, moving from this part of the lesson to the next. And there's a routine that some teachers have built that is so clear, so well worked, that the kids move almost effortlessly from one to the other. So I think we shouldn't be looking so much at the perform element, and much more we should be taking time to think about our profession and time to think, study those transitions, study those routines. And I think that might be one of the biggest shifts in my attitude towards education. That when I first qualified as a teacher, I think probably it would be fair to say that my teaching was 80% rapport and 20% routines. And I would like to think that I've got a much better balance now, maybe sort of 25% rapport and 75% routine, yeah. because there are routines that work and work brilliantly. And we should be, and some of, I see this in primary schools particularly, where they've decided to have an absolute nailed down approach to numeracy and literacy, where there is almost no individual teacher to it. It's a team delivering a extremely well-researched, brilliant, brilliantly proven approach to teaching numeracy and literacy, and those kids are absolutely flying. And then all the creativity and the rapport and the innovation comes in everything else. It's almost like we've got that frame now, that yeah. really rock solid frame, and then we've got the freedom to innovate. But there in other and I go back to the PISA, I see this quite often. Some of the countries that do very, very well in PISA, they've got a much more of a frame than we do have here. Yeah. I think we're quite individualistic in terms of, I trained for 4 years to be a teacher, you know, get my degree and my teacher training. So I'm the expert and I'll design my lessons. And if Billy gives me a lesson to follow, I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to follow his lesson plan. Whereas there's other countries where actually, you know what, there are some set plans that we're going to follow. Not all day, every day, but there's your frame and that's your springboard. And I'm much more persuaded by those these days. And I think, yes, rapport is super important and charisma and engagement is super important, the personality of the teacher. But my approach has shifted. I think it ought to be less reliant on that and more yeah. of a balance between frame and rapport, this sense of sequence, of transition, of having a really clear focus. You know, like direct instruction, you know, that's getting a resurgence because it's absolutely brilliantly well researched and some amazing ways to ensure that we understand exactly where the kids are now to take them to the next level. It's not a presumptive level. It's absolutely very clearly defined because we're checking in, and there's these amazing routines for checking in with them. So yeah. It's all fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. And I guess when it comes to teacher professional learning, there are different reasons for it as well. You know, there's the stuff about knowledge and information and how to do things and perhaps different approaches and ideas. But then there's also that part of teacher professional learning that I think is about the joy of learning. You know, we want our children to have that joy of learning, but also we want our teachers to continue to enjoy learning and have that experience as well. So sometimes our professional learning spaces are also about that sustaining element as opposed to the training or development element of teaching.
Yes. Yeah. Many, many moons ago, I was presenting at a conference down in Invercargill in right at the far end, bottom end of New Zealand. And the other keynote speaker, she did something absolutely fascinating. She, because it was for leaders and new leaders. Mm. I think they called it the New Principles Conference, something like that. And she said, so how much time would it take to prepare an excellent lesson? And she got hands up for anyone, say 5 minutes, 10 minutes, mm-hmm. 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and so on. And the vast majority of people lifted their hands at about the hour mark. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, this is interesting. And she says, and, you know, in primary schools, you're teaching 20 lots of one-hour lessons. And in high schools, you're teaching 15 lots of one-hour lessons. Okay. So can you just do the maths for a moment? So let's say you're teaching 20 lessons, each one lasts an hour, but you're going to take an hour to prepare each one. So now you've got 40 hours. Okay. In terms of assessing each student's work, how long does that take to understand where they're at? Now, primary teachers obviously you're going to be teaching 10 different subjects to 30 kids, but to high school teachers, you're teaching 250 kids, typically one lesson. So just do that. Anyway, you can see where this was going. Yes. These new principals basically had an expectation that everyone was doing 150-hour week, and it's just like, it ain't sustainable. What's going to give? And we don't have the budget to reduce the number of lessons we teach by half. So what are you going to teach? For every lesson that you spend an hour planning, you're going to have to wing another 10 lessons and make, you know, the classic five-step lesson plan. And that's the lesson plan you make in the last five steps before you enter the classroom. You know, yeah. You're going to have to just wing it if you're spending all that. And I think that was a real moment of, yeah, what are our expectations of our colleagues here? It's you know, and I'm going to come and observe you teach, and the teacher spends an hour and a half preparing that lesson. Is that really representative? Or should we be seeing it as experimental? I'll be in classes today, so if you want to try something new and different, know that I'm around. I'll roll up my sleeves and I'll get clarty with the bends, and we'll see how we go with this. And you know, you've got the extra support. There's 2-3 of us in the classroom now to try new things, and we ought to be taking it as, I'm not checking on anything, I'm giving you the opportunity to experiment here, because rather than just getting through the curriculum, I'm here, we'll try new things, try out the things that you wanted to try, that you've been thinking about junior coaching, and then we can chat about it afterwards. I think that we have to get to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. James, we could talk for much longer, I'm sure, but we are out of time.
We've run out of time.
In some ways. but we would like to finish with a couple of questions that we always finish with, and sometimes we don't repeat them, but it's been so long since we chatted to you the last time. I'm sure you're not reading the same book that you were back in October 2020. So what are you reading at the moment?
a bit naughty, really, because with Mother's Day coming up, and my wife is a voracious reader, and the kids, in inverted commas, as in me, have bought her Wifedom, about Mrs. Orwell and the life of Mrs. Orwell, and I'm enjoying reading that. before the kids present it to her on Sunday. So I'm enjoying reading that, and I've just finished the Flamboyantry. But I've got a stack of books. I mean, an absolute stack of books, and I tend to dip into them and I find something fascinating. And actually, why I write books is because it forces me to read a lot more, but it tends to be the meta-analyses and so on. And I think I probably read John Hattie's Visible Learning, the sequel. I probably read it almost cover to cover in the first week it was out. And I'm not trying to get brownie points from John here. It's because I was writing at the time, and I thought, well, hang on a minute, what about? And I think I'm 53 now, so I've got 2 years before officially I could retire. I mean, I couldn't afford to, but apparently I could retire. And I think that all I will do is swim and read, and maybe try and do both at the same time. But as soon as I retire, I'm going to spend a lot more time reading.
Maybe just don't take your wife's present to this one.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, James, as Sarah said, covered a lot today. Is there something that you want to leave listeners with, some prompt, something to think about, quote, some final thoughts from you?
One quote, and it comes from a really good mate of mine in Western Australia, originally from Dublin, actually. It still sounds as if he's from Dublin, even 30 years after being in Australia. But be true to your season. And I think about that a lot. I am a much different teacher today than I was in my 20s and my 30s. And I think that in my 20s, I had the arrogance of youth, and I thought that best teachers are the ones who are similarly energetic as I am. And I would look at the 50-somethings and think, maybe it's time to retire. You know, the arrogance of youth. But I think Brendan says, be true to your season. I shouldn't try to be some daft young thing anymore. You know, I've got something different to share with my colleagues and my students. And I did some filming last week, some model lessons, and I reflected on that thinking, wow, I'm a very different teacher than I used to be. And it is about the sequences, and it is about the strategies, and it is about the transitions, and less about the charisma and the energy. And that's reassuring to an old fella. But I wish I could have a word with my 20-something self and say, look, just stop being so damn arrogant. And you know what? We all offer something different to these kids, and they all need something different. And different stages, and it's that rich tapestry of life.
I love that. Be true to your season. I think that's that feels very empowering, and it also feels very, very grounded at the same time, because I think we can end up in that sort of battle with ourselves sometimes about who should we be. We can get caught up in how we think other people see us, or what we think other people think about us, but actually being true to your season, whatever that means, is quite a grounded and yet empowering thing to be. James, thank you once again for taking the time to dive deeper into particularly engagement and all things around that today. But as ever, you will have given plenty to our listeners to think about and to chew on over the coming weeks. So thank you.
Thank you for the invitation, and good to see you both again.
Thanks for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it and found it useful. If you enjoy listening, you can support us by following on your preferred platform, sharing on social media, or leave us a review. Thanks again.